I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
A little bit of shithole weather. 52 degrees with a steady rain in Hickory, North Carolina. Decreasing clouds with mostly sunny skies by the afternoon. Looking for a high around 70. The chance of rain, 100%. Rainfall near a quarter of an inch. And a picture of a U.S. Postal Service truck. Neither rain nor sleet nor something else. Snow. Something about snow. We'll keep the mail from its appointed place. Joining me, Alex Hollings, testing out a new microphone. So if his voice sounds really high-pitched or off, it's not him. It's the microphone.
Well, if it sounds high-pitched, it's because I haven't gone through puberty yet. But we'll blame the rest on the microphone.
There you go. Oh, it sounds a little hot.
Yeah, I got to tell you. So I think that maybe part of the issue is I need some of that software that you use to regulate.
Yeah, that's you know what? Honestly, that's normally the problem. Or if I could give you some advice, if you could just back away a little bit sometimes, that will help.
How's that? Is that any better?
Yeah, that sounds normal.
Awesome. Okay, great.
All right, there you have it. All right, problem solved.
See, this is why you need an expert in the biz when you're buying equipment like this, right? This is a hand-me-down microphone. Fortunately for me, my little brother is very adept at the internet arts, so I'm able to lean on him.
Now, your brother's a gamer, though. He's a professional gamer, though, right?
He is. Well, now he organizes professional gaming tournaments.
This is amazing. If you've never seen this, I was like, what?
And honestly, it's still foreign to me. It's the world that he lives in, so it isn't to him. But this idea of esports, and when you go to other countries especially, they fill stadiums in South Korea.
It's shocking when you see that. You see down on the hockey arena or where the basketball court is, you see these suites, and these dudes are in it, and these girls are in it, and you know they're what they're doing is being projected on the big screen at times, and you look in the stands, and it's like packed, and you're like, whoa, I didn't even know this existed.
You know, and to me that seems boring, but I will readily admit that I love watching football. And my brother was like, well, what's the difference between you watching someone play football and me watching somebody play a game that I like? And I was like, I suppose logically I can't establish a difference.
Right.
But to me, there is a very distinct one, you know, because I'm like, well, these football players, I mean, they're phenoms. They're athletic specimens. They're doing this thing that none of us can do. And my brother said, yeah, but you need to understand that in order to be competitive enough at, you know, Overwatch, you need to be a phenom. You need to be some kind of a, you're doing something that the rest of us just can't seem to do. And I understand that there is a skill set involved because I'm actively bad at video games. But I can't get into watching them, I guess. I feel like the little brother watching my big brother play games, waiting for my turn, you know?
That is, yeah, no, when I first saw it, I was like, what? And then you look and like, look, I mean, every generation, right, has their own things that they're into. And, I mean, the X Games are a good example. The first time I heard about that, like anybody's ever going to watch that on TV.
That's a great point.
Right? And then it's like, you know, you see these little weirdo doofus, right, skateboard dudes who were in your neighborhood. All of a sudden, the guy's on national TV. He's making huge amounts of money. This game, same thing with snowboarding, was just like this kind of hobby, part of this crazy skateboarding, snowboarding, you know, lifestyle. And now it's one of the biggest events. You know, like watching somebody come down a mountain timed, you know, is one thing. Watching them do acrobatics, which combines gymnastics with snowboarding, to me is a much better spectator sport now.
Yeah, and you're totally right in drawing that parallel. I wouldn't have thought of it, but the X Games was kind of my generation. You know, I grew up watching Tony Hawk be awesome on TV, and even though I never really got into skateboarding, it was definitely like part of the cultural fabric of my childhood, right? And now the X Games and those sorts of sports are in the Olympics. You know, it's we all kind of embrace and acknowledge that it's a real thing. And I suppose we'll probably end up doing the same with esports. And as much as I like playing video games, I don't think that I will end up being one of the adopters. I'm probably never going to be able to watch people play games. I just – it's a little too new for me. I'm outside the age demographic.
Wow. And who would think that you would be that guy? You'd be the stodgy older brother that wouldn't recognize –
man, I totally turned that corner. I mean, you and I talked about it. When I was running the loadout room for a while, I had to do video content. And I was like, well, my brother sent me the software – I can't figure out how to open a new project, how to like file new. I couldn't figure out. I'm only 35. I shouldn't be this far behind the curve, but the curve is moving so quickly that, you know, the expertise that I garnered from like 1999 to 2005 just doesn't really work anymore, you know?
All right, I want to ask you serious stuff going on the planet these days. And so one thing's that's in my head is 52% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And we're now working on no pay due for the third time for a lot of people. Now, I see people on TV wearing really nice clothes who I don't believe have missed a paycheck. And they're telling other people the need to stay home, right? And I'm thinking, in my life, in the times that I've been in that position, are some of the worst experiences of my life. How am I going to get through this? And is my landlord, who I pay rent to, is he or she going to tell me, yeah, Mac, don't worry about those 3 months of rent? Are they going to say that?
Well, especially if the banks are telling them you need to be making your mortgage payment.
Right. And so how do I do that? And you're telling me to stay home, right? And I've gone to Home Depot, and we've all learned how to space out. I do it at the supermarket. So if I can do those things in those places, why can't I do those things in other places?
I think that this is an important thing to discuss. And
let me just give you some California stuff. Why don't you like take admission off the parking lots at the beach, you know, in places that have them like Huntington Beach and whatnot? Why don't you let us go there for free? We'll social distance. We'll take care of our kids, right? And why can't I go hiking on a trail? Why have you shut that down to me too? So to me, like, we get it. I'm responsible for me. And I need to be able to go back to work for those of us that aren't in that target demographic that's most at risk. And I need you to loosen up the shackles a little bit because I can't live like this anymore. So your thoughts on that stuff?
Well, you know, you and I come from different positions on this, and I think that's important and good. Where I think the reason why a lot of these rules are in place, which it's important to know, I live in Georgia where the stay-at-home order was only issued about a week ago because our governor said that he didn't know the virus could be transmitted by people who were asymptomatic, you know?
How about that story, which, you know, the DOD believes that their asymptomatic cases are 60 to 70%.
Right? Well, there's a solid chance that their asymptomatic cases are 50 to 80% above even what we think.
Right.
But that's the problem, though, is the problem is a lot of us are working on suppositions that are informed by our existing position.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that we don't know that it's 60 to 70% of the asymptomatic ones. We don't know that 50 to 80% of people may have already been exposed to this virus and may even have antibodies for it. We're working on a lot of extrapolations based on the limited data sets that we have, right? So when we're working with extrapolations, we have to decide whether or not we want to emphasize preventative action or reactive action, right? So right now, we're erring on the side of preventative action, I would contend, because we genuinely still don't have really strong data sets. We're still not testing as widespread as we'd like to be, both for the virus and for the antibodies. As those tests get rolled out, we'll have real data to work with. But I had this conversation with someone on Facebook this week where I agree. We need to be looking for opportunities to get this economy working again. But at the same time, we need to not cherry pick the data or the suppositions and extrapolations that we like and disregard the ones that we don't in order to defend our positions or our arguments, right? So on the one hand, I say there's a really high likelihood that I may have already been exposed to this virus. I may have already gone through whatever symptoms I may have experienced. Maybe I had a scratchy throat for a few days and didn't really think much of it. I may even have the antibodies that would prevent me from really being worried about it if I were exposed to it again. You may well be in that same situation. But the fact of the matter is that neither of us know, right? Right. And the vast majority of other Americans are in the same position that we are. We genuinely have no idea if we've already had it and we're out of the woods, if we've never had it and we should be worried, if our bodies are already developing the antibodies to protect us from it. We just don't know, right? So when we make these extrapolations, when we say the DoD thinks it's possible that maybe 70% of its sailors, you know, don't have to worry about this, that's a great thing. It's a really good thing that we think that's possible. But we cannot, send the Roosevelt back out to sea with the same crew and assume it's going to pan out that way. Right. We have to take preventative action to perform good operational risk management. Right. We need to make sure that we are protecting as many people as we feasibly can, both from medical ramifications and from economic ramifications of the situation. But the problem that we run into is that you say very well that, you know, we understand how social distancing works. You can trust us to put on our big boy pants and go do what needs to get done. Get work done, get our jobs moving again, go shopping again. And if we exercise individual responsibility, then we're still going to be fine. And I couldn't agree with you more. The problem is how many Americans do not exercise that individual responsibility, which is the reason why these stay-at-home orders were issued in the first place, right? We should have logically, as a people, said to one another, hey, this probably won't kill me, but it could very feasibly kill my friend or my mom or my best buddy or my coworker or my manager. So I'm not going to go to the store unless I need to. So I'm going to cancel my trip to the mall this week to go buy some new shoes. We should have been able to do that as responsible.
You know what? We didn't. I don't think I agree with that because, you know, to me it was a big theoretical. You heard people saying, you know, whatever, everybody's overreacting. And that was on the upside, right?
Well, everybody's overreacting.
Everybody's overreacting.
This is like an overreaction until it works.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I don't think as a nation we're there anymore. Now, look, there's some people that, you know, right, you can't save them from themselves, right?
But that's the problem.
Right? And so
we're not trying to save them from themselves. We're trying to save our friends and neighbors from them.
But again, the solution can't be worse than the problem. And the problem that you're talking about is, I mean, the forecast keeps getting revised every, you know,
the
it seemed like every 10 days.
To get revised, though. That's the point.
It's gone from 200,000 to less than 60,000 is
now,
the forecast.
Now, do you think that it wouldn't have been revised if we had not?
No, I agree with you. But you can't, and I'll tell you this from being an elected official and sitting on the Board of Public Health. If you leave it to the health people, we won't go back to work for another 90 days.
I think you're right there. But if you leave it to the businessmen, we wouldn't have stopped going.
No,
in the
so
first
to
place.
Me, no, I agree. To me, the hard position that governors find yourself, and I've just got an email asking about what COVID-19 is doing in Georgia, and you can answer that in a second. The hard position that governors find themselves in is a political position. They do not want somebody that challenges them to have the audio that says, Governor XYZ, fill in the blank, right, was not the leader the state needed during this crisis, and my husband, wife, whatever, is dead because of him or her.
You're right.
Right? And so, because politicians, word number one is, how do I get reelected? How do I use this crisis to position myself to be uncontested and crush everything in the next election? And so I can't do that. So in weighing this desire, and in my opinion, this need for people to go back to work. And
it is an essential need.
Right. And the public health people looking at me saying, you know, look, Governor, if you want it to be 100% sure – then nobody's going back to work till September. So you have to understand, as you craft this decision, when you begin to, no matter how much goodness is in it, there's going to be people that die.
You're right, and that's so, where we come back to that operational risk management thing, right? You have to mitigate threats to the best of your ability, but it's impossible to eliminate them.
Right.
Right? So, what's interesting to me
about that, Alex, is that when you're a dynamic decision maker, when the enemy has a vote, right? When if you're responding to, you know, a natural disaster, when nature has a vote, that is very much ingrained in the mentality of decision makers that I can't make this without risk. But when you're talking about political issues, what happens is they can think it to death, right? They can study it to death, and they can say, okay, we believe that. Well, you don't, this is a dynamic event, and you're watching machinery that is crafted to do deliberate decision-making now attempting to reconcile itself with dynamic decision-making. And you can see, I mean, I'll tell you, case, you know, to me, case in point number one is the governor of New York, who, in my opinion, went on TV, right, and told every city in the country that they were going to follow New York City's path. Hadn't happened. What happened? Well, every city isn't like New York City. We don't. Every city's not as dense and don't have a mature mass transit system that is an incredible incubator for this stuff. And so I think watching him every day, in my opinion, overreact to it, which maybe he did deliberately, maybe he didn't, to me, has been very interesting. So I think in all of that has to come a way, a path out of this thing, right, that serves both, that accounts for the testing and the public health aspect, but also recognizes, right, that people have got to be able to go back to work because we're crushing half the population, a percentage of the people that work paycheck to paycheck that have been thrown out of work are being crushed by this.
No, you're absolutely right. But I think that, and I'm not accusing you of this, but I do think that a lot of people have made the mistake of blaming authority for the situation.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's stupid.
You know, like I've got a real good friend whose name I obviously won't mention, but he and I have had a lot of debates about this. Because he effectively sees an order from the government. I think a lot of Americans see an order from the government as inherent disrespect to the citizen,
right?
The government has no right to tell me what to do. This is a free country, right? Now, obviously, we can all come up with extenuating circumstances where the government does tell us what to do. Try to open a lemonade stand in Massachusetts and the police will come, right? But I absolutely understand and even appreciate, as the type of guy that I am, as the gun owner that I am, the Uncle Sam should leave me alone, right? That's how I want the government to be involved in my life. I've lived most of my life in rural places. I'm accustomed to not needing direct interaction with the government in order to get by. And I think a lot of other people, especially tend to be more conservative people, share that experience with me, where we don't want Uncle Sam's hand to be involved in our day-to-day life. The problem is
– So this is quite the flip for you, right?
It is the flip for me, and I think that there are circumstances that dictate a requirement for you to be a little loose when it comes to these things. One, for instance, being, you know, you're right that the economy is really, really suffering from this, and you're right that the models are changing, and you're right that more data is coming in all the time. The problem is that we expect the government to have – not just an answer, but the right answer, right? And right now, the government, just like the rest of us, is operating with extrapolated data, right? And that's why the models change. As we do things that change how things progress, the models change to reflect. We have a little bit more data. We make another decision. The models change to reflect. The government does not know what the right answer is yet, because to be totally honest.
I just want to add, in my opinion, an important factor. There's 50 different state governments
that are involved in this.
Right. And then a territory of Puerto Rico, territory of Guam. Right.
And it's worth noting.
So it's 52 separate
nations.
Right.
You know, so their governments are involved.
So for the United States, it's 50 different. And then even inside those states, right? Counties are as different as night and day in all of this.
Oh, in Georgia especially.
Right.
Absolutely.
So what works in Atlanta does not work, right?
And this is the problem I have with firearm legislation on the national level too, right? But I think this is why it's good that governors are able to individually enforce rules as opposed to the Trump administration enforcing a national lockdown. I think that was a good play.
No, absolutely.
However, I think basically what we need to remember is that when these orders come down from the governor's office or even the county seat, right, the reason why these orders come down is not to tell Mike McNamara what he should be doing. Mike McNamara is a responsible adult. It's not to tell me what I should be doing either. It's really about the lowest common denominator. You have to legislate for the lowest common denominator. And when I was at Walmart yesterday, right before the senior hour start, when I needed to get out of there, I saw a lot of people wearing masks. I saw a lot of people wearing gloves. I saw a lot of people just exercising good social distancing. And I also saw a number of people, and this might be specific to southern states.
No, it's not.
But I saw a number of people who were openly trying their best to show how they were not going to adhere to these dumb lines and tape on the floor and this government conspiracy to shut us all down when COVID. I saw a mom and dad with their three kids running around and being very outspoken about how dumb the masks were that they were seeing on people. Obviously, we can't get everybody to do the right thing, right? But we can encourage people to do the right thing. And in some places, they've even opted to enforce that by law. I would argue, though, that you haven't really heard a lot about people being arrested en masse over violating social distancing. You haven't heard about people being arrested for demanding to go back to work. And you haven't heard about companies facing real legal trouble for staying open other than intense pressure, both political and business pressure. The reason for that is that our government is really aware of how averse the American people are to having their liberties infringed, especially their liberty from inconvenience. Whereas you see in nations like South Korea, where they did a really good job of buttoning this up very quickly, that they were able to do that in part because they have 21 ICU beds per 1,000 people and America has 2, but also in part because the South Korean culture and people were more accepting of what we would consider to be draconian measures to stem this flow, right? Americans, by and large, will not be told what to do. And because of that, the government ends up having to take more aggressive measures than maybe they even would have liked to, because you have to legislate for that lowest common denominator. So when people like you and I are frustrated and I say, explain to me the logic of closing the park at the end of my street so I can no longer take my daughter into the woods, but I can very easily go to Walmart and wait in line close enough to feel the lady behind me's breath on my neck, and you would consider that to be a safe and essential activity. I agree. There's lots of dumb involved here, but there's also a lot of just trying our best, and we're not good as a people of accepting when the government says we're not sure. We want Donald Trump to speak in absolutes, and when he speaks in absolutes, we hate him for it. We want the CDC to speak in absolutes, and when they speak in absolutes, we hate them for it. We don't want news that we don't want, but we demand the news that we do. And what we really need to understand is that this is a live situation that is changing by the day, right? So our approach to it has to change by the day as well. The government can't necessarily say, we don't have all the data. Just like Donald Trump has to say, anyone who wants to get tested can get tested. But if you come state by state level, if I right now said that I wanted to be tested, I wouldn't be, right? But the government needs to say testing is going great so that we can maintain confidence both in our system and in our economy, right? The governors then need to say, no, we aren't testing as well as we need to. We need more resources because the testing isn't there and they don't want to be blamed for it, right? So if it's not my fault as the governor, it's got to be his fault as the president. When the reality is, it's a massive and complicated undertaking that we're amidst right now. And even if you did everything right, it takes time. And even if you do everything right and it takes time, some days are going to be worse than others. But we're grading Trump and we're grading our governors on a day-to-day metric where we say, we know for sure there's a right answer and we don't think you're giving it to us. The truth is nobody's really sure what the right answer is right now. And I think we need to give the Trump administration, we need to give the state governors a little bit of leeway in how they try their best to exercise their own best judgment with the data they have on hand. You're right. To protect their political careers, certainly. But to a certain extent, doing this well is the best way to protect your political career. I think the reason why we see breaks in calm from the federal to the state government level, the reason why we see nursing homes like the one my mom works at being completely out of PPE, despite the fact that every news release that Trump goes on says, we're bringing in millions of masks. We certainly are. It just takes a while. Right. You know, it takes a long time. Even if we had all the masks that we'd ever need, for them to make it first to the hospitals that need them the most in New York. But per capita, the nursing homes in rural America need them just as bad, right? If 10 people out of 100 die there per capita, it's still very severe for that community. But it's going to take time for those masks to trickle down through the system, first to the big pools and then to the smaller pools that need them. But we're going to blame Trump today for the masks not being there today. We're going to blame the governor of Georgia, the governor of Michigan, the governor of New York today for things not being better when we knew it was bad yesterday. The truth is that our system is huge. So we're trying our best to make things work as quickly as we can. But I don't think that there is a right answer right now. I think that the best we can do is the best we can do. And because of that, there's going to be people who are upset, people who want a sure answer, people who just think that the government is doing a bad job, which I would argue is a little bit inherent to every American. We all have that suspicion, you know, and the truth is that sometimes the government is doing a bad job, right? The fact that we –
well, you know what, Alex, I think, though, it's – a lot of it is the difference between static decision-making and dynamic decision-making. And so to me – you know, what governors have to do is tell the state that, hey, look, we are not going to all come out of this universally. There's going to be different measures for different counties,
and as there should, right?
Right, and there's a possibility that if we don't do it right, we're going to go backwards. And I want everybody to understand that. But this is a moving event. This is not you get on, you know, at Lexington and you get off, you know, at Broad. It's not how this is going to work. So our ability to take further steps is going to be based on the steps we take being right and good and then being executed well. So if we say, okay, we believe that we can open beaches, we can open the park at the end of your street, right? We expect you to do the same social distancing that you've been doing, you know, for the most part. And again, I agree with you. Not everybody. There's 10% of idiots that do that shit, right? And so we expect you to do that. If we can do that well, the next step is this. And so to me, but it's different, as you said. You know, 1 week, the president, he got criticized for not locking the whole country down. And less than, 10 days later, he was criticized for not bringing the nation out of the lockdown all in lockstep uniformly. And you're like, wait a minute, how can it be both ways, right?
And I think this really speaks to the real cancer that this nation is facing, other than the coronavirus. The real cancer, I would argue here, is our fierce partisanship. You know, we're drawing battle lines on political part.
Fueled by our partisan media, right?
Absolutely. So, I would argue fueled by our partisan media, but also fueled by the market for partisan media.
All right. No,
right?
Absolutely.
If you don't like Donald Trump, you want to be mad at him for this. And if you do like Donald Trump, you want to congratulate him for what a good job he's doing in this. The fact of the matter is that right now might not be a great time for us to be more worried about polling numbers you know, than we are about our own neighborhood, right? And what we want to do is we want to look at Donald Trump with a magnifying glass and say, this is what you did wrong. This is what maybe you did right. And we're doing the same thing on the state level, but we're also doing the same thing on a business-by-business level. If the nation decided to open up tomorrow, many businesses still wouldn't, right? Because those decisions were made by the business's CEO, their board, their executive team, things like that, for the same reasons governors are worried about their polling numbers, CEOs are worried about theirs, right? USAA is a great example. They took a lot of flack in the press over this past week or two because people whose bank accounts were already overdrawn were getting their stimulus payment, and they weren't receiving the stimulus payment because their bank account was overdrawn. And USAA was accused of taking these people's stimulus payments when they needed it most. Now, we could argue back and forth about whether or not were they really taking it, or were they just owed money, right? Or are they just going to forgive that debt in order to give you that stimulus payment? There's a lot of moving parts there, but that's not what the headline reflects, right? The headline reflects USAA is stealing service members' money when they need it the most, right? So USAA needed to pivot, right? They needed to pivot very quickly last week to say, we're not doing that anymore. We heard what you're saying. The truth is always a little bit more complicated than the mob wants it to be, right? And we're seeing it business level, we're seeing it state level, and we're seeing it at the federal level, where we expect these people to know all the right answers, even though maybe we don't ourselves. And when we see that maybe they don't, it really degrades our trust in them and in the apparatus as a whole, right? So I think you're 100% right that this needs to be on a local by local level decision made, right? I promise you right now in Montana, there are lots of places where you don't really need to have a stay at home order, but you do need probably to maintain social distancing again, because our concern is not, to be totally frank, the total number of people that may end up dying overall to this. A lot of people are going to die either way, right? The problem, our fear, our concern, is overwhelming the medical infrastructure so that people who wouldn't have died don't. And that's what that's I think what gets lost in all this, is we're focusing so much on that 40,000 people have died. And then other people say, yeah, but how exactly are we counting this? And then we're saying, well, maybe 200,000 people will die. Okay, but how are we counting that? The real number that we need to be worried about is the in and outflow of our hospital infrastructure. A bunch of people are going to die either way. So if we're going to use the dying number as our metric for success, then we're going to end up failing all of our leaders. They're all going to seem like a failure because people are going to die, right? So what we need to be focused on is staying below that threshold where if you have a heart attack that you shouldn't have died from, you're not going to die from it. But if the hospitals get overwhelmed and there isn't a bed for that heart attack patient, or the hospitals get overwhelmed and that kid with a broken foot that wouldn't have lost their foot under normal circumstances but now ends up losing their foot because they delayed treatment. We need to be worrying about mitigating that stuff instead of this overall death toll, which, to be honest with you, it's a fudgy number, right? If you are 98 years old and you were already in a really seriously degraded immunosystem because you had pneumonia and you're 98 and you pass away due to COVID-19, your tally on that count counts just as much as a healthy 22-year-old EMT who happened to die from it as well, right? But those healthy 22-year-olds are the ones we're actually scared of dying. The 98-year-old, as awful as this sounds, it is to a certain extent, it's a part of the normal process that we wouldn't have been keeping account of under normal circumstances.
Okay, hold on. Let me bring you back. So in 60 seconds or less, how do you bring Georgia out of this?
To be honest with you, if I were able to do it and I were in charge.
If you're the governor.
If I'm the governor of Georgia, assuming that the resources were available, I would enforce antibody testing as widely as I possibly could, because there's a solid chance that 70% of the population of the state might have nothing to worry about, right? So I would expand testing for COVID-19 and expand testing for the antibodies as rapidly and as widely as feasibly possible. And I would start in the urban centers because that's where we're going to see the most economic impact, both in a negative and in a positive light. If I could get widespread antibody testing enforced very rapidly, I think we could.
But I don't think you can do that, so I'm not going to grant you that. You can't do that in the short term.
If you can't do that, then we're going to need to do this a little bit more slowly than most people would really want. We're going to need to be aware of the economic impact.
So what does that mean? What does a little bit more slowly mean, Governor?
What it means is I would need to see not just our infection rate, but the number of positives per testing capita. So that I could keep an eye on the metrics, right? So it's not just about how many people are positive in your state. It's also about, for every 100 tests that we do today, how many of those are coming back positive? If it's like 6%, that means that the community spread is not that significant. And in some smaller areas, in some rural areas where social distancing is absolutely practicable, I'd say open business up. But the thing is that in Georgia, they still are. You see in other states where maybe Walmart is taping off all non-essential purchases. You see in other states where stores are being told to close. Georgia has, for the most part, not really done that. When I went to Walmart yesterday, you could buy anything that you want. The hardware stores are still open.
Yeah, I haven't seen that here in California either. I've read the stories, but I've not seen. I go to Target, and then I go to supermarkets, and I've not seen any segment of any store
that's blocked off, right?
That's
the problem, though, is that the narrative is that our whole country is shut down. But the truth is that these things are not being enforced in a draconian.
Okay, hold on. You're getting away from your role as governor and how you're going to bring the state out.
The way you bring the state out, and I know you're not going to like this answer, is with a slow and gradual day-by-day decision-making process based on the data at hand. It is not
I get that because it's a dynamic event. Okay, Governor, what do you say to the people that are living paycheck to paycheck that are out of money and the $1,200 they're going to get from the federal government is not going to do anything for them? They're already overdrawn. They're getting their food from food banks, right? They can't make their car payment. They can't buy gas. What do you say to them?
I would say to them the hard truth, that is, this isn't going to be easy. That's just the fact of the matter. The fact that you're out of money is awful, and it's something that we need to work on a solution for. But the fact that you're out of money isn't a reason for us to overwhelm the hospital infrastructure so that this becomes even worse for people like you and like me 3 months from now.
Okay, so tell me how – so the metric that you're going to focus on is what? And if my county is where, would you allow us to begin to go back to work?
The metrics. It cannot be a single metric. You're falling into that same –
you're the one that just said it like 2 minutes ago. The number to focus on is
– I said the numbers – you need to have – and I know you've been in dynamic situations before where you couldn't just say this is the problem and this is the solution. The metrics that we need to focus on
are what?
The COVID-19 positive testing, B, the antibody testing, and C, the infection rate among those tested, right? Now, what I would say is that we could start opening up communities as we can start expanding testing within those communities. I know that what you want from me – is to paint myself into a corner and say,
No.
There are no corners here.
What I want is your solution to this.
My solution is the same as it was in January when we argued about this.
But when you tell me that part of your solution doesn't exist yet, and I don't have any money, what do I do? And you're not hope's not a COA. And that's what you're giving me is hope.
But what I'm telling you is that the governor of a state cannot solve all economic problems for every individual there. So the same way that a couple of minutes ago you were arguing that no matter what we do, this is going to be bad and people are going to die. I'm going to argue with you that no matter what we do, this is going to be bad and people are going to go broke. This is a bad situation, and the governor can't solve it with a magic wand. The president can't solve it with a magic wand. Asking me for a magic wand doesn't change it. So what I'm saying is this is bad. It's going to be bad, even if it goes the best that it can. We need to work on solutions. We need to solve problems a dozen at a time instead of all at a time. And we need to understand that no matter what we do,
this is going to start. Is it fair if I think the difference between our two approaches is that you would keep us locked up longer, right? Skewing towards the side of
– Well, I would keep us locked up as we are, which you and I both said. Businesses aren't closed around where we live. Stores are open. People are shopping. Yeah, that level of lockdown I think is perfectly appropriate where we go on TV and say practice social distancing. That's perfectly appropriate.
Right.
I know that a lot of small businesses are closed, but I can tell you right now, one of my good friends is a welder and he has not missed a day of work here in Georgia.
Right.
There are communities where the businesses are closed down, where Walmarts are taped off. And maybe in those communities, we can change the way we're doing it. But the questions that you're asking me aren't in line with the experiences that you or I are having.
Well,
you're saying should we stay locked down? I'm saying we're not that locked down as we are.
What I'm saying is that I believe if I can go into Home Depot and I can stand on the tape 6 to 8 feet apart from the person in front of me, if I can do that in a supermarket, why can't I do that in other places?
I would say the same. I would ask you, though, who do you hold culpable if people don't?
Well, again, this is I don't hold anybody culpable.
If people don't practice social distancing and we rapidly do overwhelm the hospital infrastructure, you wouldn't even hold the governor responsible.
Well, wait a minute. You listen to Governor Cuomo, right? Do his Chicken Little thing. Right. Last week, they're sending ventilators to other states.
And this is what I'm asking.
Right.
You.
And you're and
you
hold on.
And
let me just finish. And so and now you're seeing medical people being furloughed in hospitals that have suspended all normal procedures. And now they're being furloughed. And so at what point, right, is the remedy? Right. Worse, if this now falls in line with flu, right, with the numbers we see from annual flu, at what point is the remedy too much?
Here's my questions for you in that same. At what point is the remedy not right? So you're saying that New York City is getting better and that's why we shouldn't have done this. There's a popular meme
I don't think I said New York City is getting better. We shouldn't have done this. I'm saying is that we've done all that, okay? And the question is, you know, how do we come out of it?
Let me ask you that question. How do you think New York comes out of this? What do you think as the dynamic decision maker? What do you think could be that magic wand you're asking me for where they could – what should the governor come out and say that makes this all better?
Well, no, there's nothing that he can do.
There isn't anything to
make it all better. So that's not – no, that's not – the question is how do you come out of it?
What's your plan as governor? If you're the governor, what do you do?
The question isn't – because you can't make it. You have to get people to understand that as we come out of this, there's going to be people that continue to get sick. There's going to be parts that reflare, and we will.
And there's still going to be people who go broke.
And we will adjust to that, okay? And we will adjust to that on a county.
We'll adjust to people dying. But my solution that will adjust to people going broke isn't a sufficient answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's way more people that are going to be financially implicated by this. Than are going to be killed. When you have a survival rate that's approaching 99%, given the rate of...
But we have a survival rate approaching that because of these measures we've instituted. If we did not institute these measures, then the hospital infrastructure would not be able to sustain
I know, but look, we've gone...
So if you turn off these measures...
We've gone through all that, Alex. And so...
As far as you're concerned, we're on the other side already.
Yes. Yes. Now I know.
That's a very dangerous assumption.
I'm not assuming that. Look, I know that if you listen,
we don't have data that says we're on the other side of this.
If you listen to Dr. Fauci, right, and Dr. Burns, B-I-R-N-Z, right. And yeah. Dr. Burns, you know that they're not comfortable with the backside testing that needs to be in every county, right, across the country. And that's not going to be here for months.
So,
right?
But your argument
so,
is genuinely,
so,
we should just open things up and see how it goes.
No, what I'm saying is that there should be a phased approach in every county.
And
in,
what are you going to do if I go broke before my phase gets here?
There's nothing I can do for you.
So what would you tell me if you were the governor? You asked me this.
What I'm telling you, what
ago.
I'm telling you is that there's going to be a phased approach, and there's a gap between the
bank account's already overdrawn.
There's a gap between the vaccine.
My business
right?
is closing.
There's a gap between the testing, but I can't keep the country and the economy locked up for that long. To please the public, how long that long is. I know I don't, but I can't keep the country locked in. What I have to bet on is, and what I'm going to tell the citizens of the county of the state is that look, our success as a state, your success as a community is going to be defined by our ability to practice these things in this area. Where we have got to allow some people to go back to work, to allow some semblance of, I won't even say normalcy anymore, but to come out of this, okay? And so I cannot keep you, you know, in this state for another 4 months until the public health people say, hey, go ahead. It would have two – we have – I'm now comfortable with the level of testing that we have around the country. Now you can go ahead and let people go back to work. I can't do that. We'll destroy the economy. And so
–
and what I want to – what I want to prepare you for –
this is a logical fallacy.
What I want to prepare you for –
you are giving me a logical fallacy.
What I want to prepare you for is in this gray area, right, of the next – 4 months, which, and I'll just say hypothetically, is when my public health people say we will have enough testing. Okay? In this gray area, our success will be defined by our ability to do public interest distancing, our ability to wear masks, our ability to be conscious of when you have symptoms, immediately stop going to work, right? Immediately get tested. We have all those abilities now. Okay.
But in your plan, no one's held accountable for any of their own actions.
In
this
term,
is what I mean.
In terms of what? Do you want me to arrest people? You want me to arrest the family that you saw in Walmart?
This is what I'm asking you because they're not doing that now.
I can't. Right? I don't think I have the means. I would love to.
I don't think that you do either.
I don't have the means to it. And I can't control them.
The problem is that this isn't an easy to solve problem.
No, I agree with you.
Just going on TV and saying, hey, guys, you should be responsible, is not enough to make many Americans responsible. And when you say it's those 10% that we can't get to, those 10% are going to do it anyway. You're right. And those 10% are what drags this out.
I don't disagree with you.
The reason why I was saying that you're arguing a logical fallacy is because your supposition is that either we stop this to save the economy or the economy is going to collapse, or we don't stop this and the economy is going to collapse. The truth is, as is the case in most things, is that this is not an either or spectrum.
You're putting those words in my mouth. I didn't say that it's an either or thing. I'm telling
you
that
use the words either
I'm,
or because
I'm
you
telling
would
you
recognize that it was a fallacy.
That the truth is somewhere in the middle, Alex, and you've got to navigate that gray area.
So that's
why we struggle with it, because it is dynamic decision making, and people do not want to put their ass in there and say, okay, here's what I can do, here's what I can't do, here's what I can save us from, here's what I can't save us from. And let
and
me tell you,
what's going on now,
as
we're not happy with it.
As we open this thing up, there's going to be people that are exposed and there's going to be people that die.
And as your governor,
it's my decision and I'm going to have to take responsibility for that. But this is what I believe and this is how this is going to work.
You still didn't present a solution, though. You said we would do a phased reopening of the country, which is the current plan.
I'm only responsible for my state. Okay.
Okay. So if phased reopening of your state,
right.
What is your plan? You asked me for mine. I think it's only fair that I ask
you
for yours.
No. So until we can get to that point, which I think everybody agrees, we've all learned from Dr. Fauci and Dr. Burke, that we that everybody who can be tested should be tested for antibodies. But we can't get there for X number of months. To that capability would be resident.
So what are we
within
now?
The states? So what the state is working on is getting the mass number of tests through technology that Dr. Burks talks about, right? With
you
Abbott
just
Labs.
Gave you the same answer I gave you.
Hold on, man. Look, if you're not going to allow me to finish my thought,
I'm sorry.
Okay,
but
and you want to go where we went a month ago?
You're
then,
putting words in my mouth.
Then
and
this
you're not being
then
fair.
This time I'm not going to be nice.
Okay. So let me ask you the questions that you asked.
You already did, and I'm trying to give you an explanation. Okay. And so I talk about where we're trying to get with our labs, right? And that when in the next few weeks, I believe that we're going to have the technology in our labs to do the mass testing that we don't have today. Okay. When that's in place, and that's going to be well short of the antivirus testing that's going to be done, right? And so by the time we have those tests in place, but before we have the antibodies test in place, what I'm going to count on as the governor and the decision I'm going to make is I'm going to begin to open up our parks. I'm going to begin to open up the beaches. I'm going to begin to open up and take the clamps off non-essential business. Our ability to keep our death toll down is going to be a function of, can we continue to do social distancing? Can we continue to work from home? Those people who can, and limit it that way. And that is the middle ground I will steer. As we enter phase one and people begin to do that, we will continue to look at the numbers. If certain communities need to go backwards and go back, we will be happy to do that. But what we're trying to do is get from here to 4 months away where we will have all those the appropriate testing in place, right? And it's going to lay upon our ability to do those things. And so it's not a perfect solution. I understand that. Will there be people that die that because of this? Yes, I understand that. But my job as a governor is to balance the public health requirement versus our economic requirement and try to steer some middle ground. And so that would be my solution.
I guess my question to you then is, how in any way is that different from what I said or what we're doing?
No, my point to you was, I believe what you're saying is I would skew towards doing that. I think you would skew more towards being more restrained and more cautious in doing that in terms of your timeline. My timeline would be sooner, yours timeline would be later.
I'm not sure that I agree, because here in Georgia where I live, most of the businesses aren't closed, right? And people are practicing social distancing for the most part. And I have not once in all the times that I've gone out or my wife has gone out been stopped or talked to by a police officer asking me what I was doing outside my house. For the most part, if you were to fly a helicopter over Georgia right now, aside from there being fewer cars in most of the parking lots, you probably wouldn't be aware that there was a pandemic going on, right? Because most people are being responsible. So when I say that in order for us to be able to open the state up, we need to be able to react to the data every day, we need to expand testing very rapidly. We need to expand antibody testing very rapidly. And we should probably focus our earliest efforts on the urban centers, because that has both the biggest economic fallout from being shut down and the greatest opportunity for economic improvement by being opened up again, right? The way that we do that is in a staged progression, just like we're currently doing. Americans are mad that the problem isn't solved today. It can't be solved today. And when you ask me, well, what do I tell that guy when he says, well, my bank account's already overdrawn? What do I tell that guy when they say I'm already broke? I'm going to say the same thing that you said about people dying, that this is a bad situation. And in bad situations, bad things are going to happen. We cannot set this up so that everyone wins. This is not an everyone wins scenario. The best thing that we can do is try to make sure the fewest people lose. Right. And that means economically, but it also means medically. Right. So we need to make sure that the people who can go to work and can get back to work. But we also need to make sure that we don't do that in a way that ends up jeopardizing our economic well-being 6 months from now. That we have to make sure we do it in a way that doesn't cripple us for a year. Because if everybody gets sick all at once and things do get bad and we're not – I know that you were saying that as far as you're concerned, we're already on the other side of the peak. If we're wrong about that, if we create a new peak in 3 months, we are worse off, right? So we need to take a progressive, in some cases gradual, move toward back to normalcy. We cannot go back to normal next week. We can't go back to normal on Wednesday.
I don't think there's any question about that. The question is how do you come out of it? Is how do you come out of it?
And yeah. I think you and I agree completely on how to come out of this.
Well, somebody
expanding testing and opening things up in stages.
Right. Somebody just sent me an email. Mac, I think that the solution to me wouldn't be sending everybody money. The solution to me would be increasing unemployment benefits and targeting those people that are out of work. What sense does it make to send somebody $1,200 that hasn't missed a paycheck? I don't get that. So to me, the mechanism that ought to be used is unemployment. The program's already there. We should just temporarily increase from, say, $400 a week as the max to $600 a week.
I think that's a really good idea.
$2,400 a month, but it targets the people that you're talking about. And that number, I believe, across the country is huge. Think about it. Everybody who worked in a restaurant, everybody who cooked, everybody who bussed, that industry, no longer there. Same thing for everybody who worked in a bar. They're unemployed. So if you start with that and then you look at some of the industries that have been hit and how you get money to them, I think it is the unemployment. I agree with you.
I think that he's 100% right. I do think that there is a value in giving a lot of Americans that $1,200 stipend on two sides of the coin. I absolutely agree with that writer, though, about unemployment. But as Mac was pointing out earlier, you know, 52% of Americans are paycheck to paycheck, right? Now, I'm really fortunate that I have a really good job, but I'm still paycheck to paycheck. I have a little bit left over when I get paid usually, you know? And the problem that we run into with a lot of Americans is that let's say you make $50,000 a year and your wife makes $55,000, and together you guys make $105,000 a year in Boston, Massachusetts with your three kids. You lead a pretty good life. You know, you're middle class, you're comfortable, you've got worries, right? You've got a mortgage to pay and an electric bill. When bad things like this happen, there's two things that usually come along with it. The first we've seen in consumer spending is there's a rapid reduction in consumer spending, not just because stores are closed, but also because people are worried about their money. You know, they're worried that, sure, my job is okay right now, but it may not be in six more weeks. You know, I'm in that position where my job is secure effectively as long as people are still shipping to basic training. If the DOD shuts down basic training, everyone that works for my company runs the risk of losing their jobs, right? But right now, I'm cool. By giving people that stipend, they're a little bit more apt to spend money, and that's really important and valuable for our economy as a whole. If they feel like they've got that cushion, they're going to go ahead and order that thing on Amazon, or they're going to go ahead and run to Walmart and buy that new video game maybe because they know their kids need something to do and it'll keep them entertained for a few days. It just gives you that little bit of breathing room where you can go, yeah, maybe I'll buy that silly thing. And that silly thing is a really important part of our economy, of keeping money changing hands. But the other reason why it's valuable is because if you're a guy like me who's basically paycheck to paycheck, but I'm securely middle class and I'm fine, but I get a reduction in employment or I get a furlough, like my buddy who works for GE was recently furloughed from the factory. Even though he's got a job to come back to in 4 weeks, theoretically, as long as everything goes well, he could really use that money right now. Unemployment as well, right? So that $1,200 stipend in the pockets of Americans who may not be desperate for it can actually really benefit us because they tend to use that money that money changes hands to other people who may really need it. You know, my family, as a good example, is using way more DoorDash and ordering way more delivery food than we ever have. You know, we're doing delivery maybe 3 or 4 times a week some weeks at this point, because in our mind, that guy that we pay $10 from DoorDash to bring us this stuff from McDonald's, that might be 10 of the only 100 bucks he makes today, and we still have a job, so that's worthwhile, you know? And Americans are doing that. Americans are, I would argue, more than ever supporting their local economies in ways that they can.
Yeah, but honestly, Alex, I don't think that if you haven't lost your job, I don't think that, you know, I don't think that any of us should have gotten, you know, extra money. I mean, for what? And I understand your general economic, I understand your general economic stimulus package, but to me, that money ought to have been targeted and whatnot.
I'd like to point out that I say that as a guy who isn't getting what I don't think, because I didn't do my taxes in 2018.
Do them in a hurry. Let me before we go real quick. Thoughts on the Roosevelt?
See, this is one of those situations where I think a lot of people are taking an A or B approach to this, and this is tough, man. You know, so first and foremost, you and I already talked about the Roosevelt, and I think that we kind of came to a consensus on. You can either think he did the right thing or think he did the wrong thing, but you still have to kind of recognize that he violated protocol.
Right.
Right. His motives may have been pure, and we might even think that they were the right thing to do, but it's still a violation. I do not think I feel as though the way that it was handled by the Navy at large was poorly. Obviously, the Secretary of the Navy poorly, and I think it does speak to the large gap between the service member and the leadership that we're seeing. And I do not think that you can fault the Trump administration specifically for this. I think that this is a cancer that's been growing, not just in the Navy, but in the military apparatus as a whole for a long time. You know, the Fitzgerald and the McCain collisions, I would argue, are part of it. All of the mishaps we saw with aircraft, particularly in the Marine Corps, but service-wide the year prior, these issues all sort of tie to, I would contend, the force being ridden hard and put away wet for too long, sequestration and continued resolution spending being an issue consistently for so long, and the general op tempo of the military being so high for so long. You take all these things and things start to get kind of bad, right? And then you take a bad situation that would have been bad anyway, and it's that much worse because of those pre-existing conditions, right? You could make the metaphor that the Navy was immunocompromised and the coronavirus is hitting it harder as a result, right? I think that there's an issue with leadership at the Pentagon level and just below being very far detached from the service member at large. And part of that may well be because there's a lot of gapped positions at the Undersecretary of Defense level, which tends to be where, like, that higher leadership meets the actual active leadership, right? When it comes to the Roosevelt specifically, I think that we have an inclination right now to politicize what's happening to these sailors and what's happened to Captain Crozier. I think that right now politicizing it doesn't do anyone any service, right? Our focus should be on getting the Roosevelt back to operating capabilities as rapidly as possible. Our focus needs to be on making sure that the sailors who need treatment receive it and receive good treatment. And our focus obviously needs to be on making sure that the virus doesn't spread throughout the force, because that'll have far-reaching implications for readiness. Those are things that we can focus on, that we can take action on today and have a real – that would make a real difference. And the after-action report, I think that we can absolutely say maybe Captain Crozier did the right thing, maybe Captain Crozier did the wrong thing. In the after-action report, if people want to have a conversation about reinstating him, that might even be appropriate then too, if you feel as though it is. But not until that after-action report. We're in the middle of the firefight still. I think it's a little bit too early for us to be talking about, you know, who the CO used to be. I think we need to be worried about the firefight.
So if you were the newest acting Secretary of the Navy or the CNO, what would you say relative to
Do you mean like to the sailors or at large?
No. First issue is, what do you do about the commanding officer of the ship? If you're the CNO, well, let's take the SecNav out of it. If you're the CNO, you've watched this thing, and somehow or other, between the ship, the strike group, the 7th Fleet, and Indo-Pacific Navy, things got screwed up. Those guys were not on the same sheet of music for whatever reason.
And I think some of that might just be that this is an unprecedented challenge.
And so then you have a guy who goes outside the chain of command. Somehow that stuff gets public. What do so the first thing you have to resolve is who's going to be the CO. Do you send that guy back to that carrier?
I wouldn't send Crozier back, not in the midst of this. I personally, you know, that obviously – this is a decision that the CNO would have to make. But personally, I would want to make sure that we had someone on that ship serving in a leadership capacity that was highly capable, highly competent, and has a pretty good rapport with the troops, right? If later on down the road we make a decision that we want to put Crozier back in command or something, that's absolutely something we can talk about. But in the midst of all this, we need steady and consistent leadership, the best that we can provide, right? And when addressing the sailors, I would say, I know that you're upset. I know that this isn't going the way that you want it to go. I can assure you that your safety and the readiness of the force are our number one priority. When all this is over, when everybody's all healed up, we can talk more about what we should do next time. But right now, let's talk about what we can do today. And if I were that same CNO or the Secretary of the Navy or I'm the Secretary of Defense, that would very much be my guidance as well. It would be... Let's make sure that leadership is in place. Let's give that leadership all the support we can possibly give it, not just for the sake of the sailors, but also for the sake of the PR, right? We need to make sure that we are being seen, actively managing the situation to mitigate that bad press, because it's going to have an effect on recruiting, right? The first and most important thing is good, strong, stable leadership right there on site. The second most important thing is managing the narrative that goes along with it. And the third most important thing, a little bit further down the road, is establishing a new SOP and even making corrections to what we've got. But right now, I think the focus has got to be on who's in charge today and what can we do today. And I think the conversation about Captain Crozier is best left for after the firefight's over.
You mean, but you've already made the decision that he's not going back.
And yeah.
So when you say the conversation relative to who shot who.
Yeah, you know, I think that I understand that the Navy's saying they're not taking anything off the table. If it were my choice personally, I don't think that I would put Crozier back in command.
I think that's boilerplate to seem unbiased, because if Crozier was right, then his strike group admiral, 7th Fleet, and Indo-Pac, all admirals, and the CNO, then they're all culpable because they didn't help the Roosevelt. When
you're absolutely right. You know?
So one of the two stories has to be right, and so and that's,
you kind of can't side with the one man versus the Navy story, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right, and as well as that. As I know you know, as a leader, it's super important not just that you can lead your troops, but you need to be able to manage laterally and up, right? You need to be able to manage your relationships with your peers and with your superiors, right? And I would argue that at this point, Crozier has compromised his relationships with his peers and his superiors too far for them to be able to say, we're going to put you in charge of a $12 billion carrier with 5,000 troops on it. That carrier has more firepower than some entire nations. So the amount of trust and confidence I have to have, not only in your ability to lead, but in your ability to work with me, has to be there. And I don't think it is for Captain Crozier.
Yeah, I don't. And then the other thing, in my opinion, you send a mixed message about is, oh, well, maybe there is an appropriate time to go outside your chain of command and leak something to the media. And so
I think
to me,
that there is.
To me, me, the Navy has to, the Navy has to come down and say, look, as a uniformed service, what we're telling you is, if you choose to do that, it's going to cost you. Yeah, it's going to cost you your career. Now, there may be times when one can cite an example and say, hey, look, all these people above me weren't doing the right thing, so I felt I had no other recourse. And then, but I saw this thing called a 4P naval correspondence that, you know, is used to flag critical issues for flag officers, general officers. And they said, you know, that was available to him. He could have done everything he did and informed up to the CNO about it, and he chose not to do that. Now, so anyway, I think that's an important message. And I will say one thing. I do kind of the parallel between Patton got relieved for slapping two soldiers in Sicily. I believe it was Sicily or Salerno. And yet he was not thrown out of the service. In fact, Band of Brothers would have been four episodes, and it would have ended at Bastogne were it not for Patton getting command of the Third Army and going fighting through two different German armies and getting to them and relieving the siege of Bastogne. Now, so to me, maybe Crozier's given another command in a year or so.
And I think that's totally feasible. Well, I do want to say, you said that I wasn't quite – you said that I was kind of flip-floppy on this, and I am. I want to clarify how and why, though, because I agree with you that I think that there is genuinely a time, there are circumstances where the right thing to do ethically, morally, as you as a person who has to look yourself in the mirror – there may be circumstances where you feel as though you need to circumvent the chain of command. You might even think that the most appropriate course of action is to go to the press. But even if you're right about making the right ethical choice, that doesn't free you from repercussion, right?
No.
The repercussion is going to be there regardless.
I don't think that's – I didn't mean to insinuate that is flip-flopping. I think that's consistent. You know if you do it – that the outcome will be, you know, certain, and that's the price you'll pay.
Absolutely, we can pat you on the back for it. But
well, unless this happens,
unless it's not founded,
the Navy finds in the investigation that Strike Group, Seventh Fleet, Indo-PACOM, were not moving right with the speed with which they should have moved, and he was absolutely justified, right, in raising the issue and being frustrated. Okay. The reason he won't go back to the Roosevelt is he did not take that to the appropriate chain of command, which would have been, right, naval forces around the world guy. And,
as far as I'm concerned, you've nailed it. That's exactly what it comes down to.
And CNO. However,
we can say that his logical chain was right, but the action he took was wrong.
Right. Right? And I have directed that all three of those flag officers be relieved. And then they would be gone, but he would be gone as well. He has the possibility to command again, depending on his competitiveness, you know, on in future boards. And so we believe, you know, but you know, everybody's going to pay a price in this, because when you go around the wheel, right, this thing got done right, and then he didn't respond to it right, and this is what we believe gets closest to the truth. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out in terms of, did the people above him get him the help that he needed, or did he just get frustrated because, you know, we went to Guam, but I couldn't put anybody ashore, I couldn't put anybody in hospitals because, the Guamanian, you know, hotel business had been shut down, and for them to recall employees to do what they had to do to open all that stuff, to provide food and all that, was taking days, and he simply got frustrated, and there was nothing really Seventh Fleet could do about it other than continue to update the situation.
Yeah, so, and I think it's entirely feasible that this was a situation that was developing faster than existing Navy procedure could adapt to, right? I think that's entirely feasible because we have a very bureaucratic system, including within the military, The question still remains, or the, I guess the issue still remains, right? When you dive on a grenade, your good intentions don't defuse the grenade, right? When that grenade went off, I think Captain Crozier was aware of the effect that this will have on his career, and I think that it had the expected effect on his career. I agree with you completely. I think that it's entirely feasible that if Captain Crozier ends up being found to be more or less in the right, you know, maybe we can fault him for what he did, but maybe his course of action was justified with certain mitigating circumstances. He ends up in command of another vessel at some point. I'm sure he'll be a troop favorite, you know. But at the end of the day, the system only works as long as we make sure the system works. And we can't normalize going outside the system, even in extreme circumstances, because in extreme circumstances are the times that we need the system to work the most.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. Well said. What's the latest at Sandbox? What's going on?
Well, we've got obviously coronavirus-related content, but we're not trying to place a real focus on that because, to be honest with you, you can talk and talk and talk about it, but it doesn't tend to make things that much better. So we're trying to only send pushes out related to coronavirus either because of official announcements are being made or because we're just saying, hey, check this out on Military One Source because they're doing some really cool things. Military One Source comes to mind. I'm writing a piece about it now. They're offering non-medical video conferencing for children, just kids that are struggling with being stuck in their house, kids that are struggling with anger management, or they're just really stressed out. Military One Source is offering free video teleconferencing with your kids, especially for parents who are trying to work from home or they're laid off and furloughed and worried, trying to school their kids from home. There are resources out there. So we're publishing stuff about that. But we're also publishing a bunch of stuff that's got nothing to do with the coronavirus so that you can have a break. You know, I had a great interview last week with Max Martini. He was in Pacific Rim, 13 hours, the unit. If there's a badass military guy in a movie, Max has played him in us. We've got an interview with him that'll be going up this week. Some more content from George Hand, a Delta Force operator. We've got lots of great stuff that's not the coronavirus, too. So please swing by sandboxnews.com. It's Sandbox with two X's. Or you can check me out on social media, facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. Twitter, I'm at AlexHollings52. Or you can always swing by alexhollings.com and shoot me an email through there. And I've got a new piece on the F-15 up on Popular Mechanics right now if you want to learn something about airplanes.
The F-15 or the X-15?
The F-15. It's actually the coolest part of the whole story is the introduction. It was about in Iraq, an F-15E Strike Eagle pilot was trying to engage Iraqi Hind helicopters. And no, they weren't able to get a lock with their AIM-9 Sidewinders, their AIM Sidewinders. So instead, they used a 2,000-pound GBU-10 bomb, a laser-guided bomb. They just kept the laser on it and increased their airspeed enough that the bomb actually made it to the helicopter as it was doing 100 knots off the ground, went through the prop and the body, exploded below it, and just evaporated the attack chopper. Just such a cool solution to a problem that they had to make in the moment, at the stick. I love stories about service members who make mission even though they don't have necessarily the equipment they need or the situation that would have allowed for it.
The nature,
you
know, of dynamic decision-making, right?
Awesome story.
And again, I think that, you know, you can see, you know, why you have a world killed to deliberate decision-making, asked to make dynamic decisions, so uncomfortable with it, so uncomfortable with the fallout of it. As well they should be, but it's been very, very interesting to watch because it's a collision of really two worlds, and the world that we're living in right now doesn't always lend itself, because of some of the time nature decisions involved in it, you know, the analyticals aren't going to always get you there. And let me tell you, I mean,
arguing and disagreeing is a super important part of this process too.
Well, you know, you can see, I mean, the actions in the state of Washington, the actions in California, are all people cried when they were taken. Right, there wasn't the empirical evidence to warrant the extent of the, you know, the actions that were taken. And yet now in hindsight, right? In hindsight, people are saying, yeah, it was those decisive actions, you know, that were that lent themselves to, right, us, you know, not having followed different paths of different states.
Different models. I mean,
right,
there's one more when we're talking about leadership, small unit leadership and leadership in general. There's one story out of the Marine Corps from this past week that I think really well exemplifies the importance of small unit leadership, and that was in New York City. Is it the Comfort in New York City? I want to say it's the Comfort.
I think so.
There are Marines at the ECP, at the entry control point for the hospital ship, right? And they normally, under normal circumstances, can support about an ambulance every 30 minutes, you know, coming in, getting the patient transferred on board. And then in the middle of the night, they received an urgent call saying a hospital was evacuating 10 ambulances worth of patients all at once. And the Marines that were on site, the senior Marine on site was a sergeant. Not only did they first get traffic stopped and organized because one of the ambulances was running out of oxygen, the patient inside, there was a high chance that the person might die if their O2 tank ran out before they got through traffic. The Marines stopped traffic, got that ambulance up to the front of the line. By the time they were able to do that, another of the 10 ambulances' oxygen reserves were running out. They got that up to the front of the line, but they realized at that point that this is going to be a problem for all 8 other ambulances, right? So the Navy personnel on board the Comfort got a bunch of freed up oxygen tanks down onto the pier. A group of Marines picked those oxygen tanks up, threw them on their shoulders, and sprinted hundreds of meters down the pier to get to that ECP, where the Marines at the ECP then picked them up and sprinted them out to the ambulances to get those people oxygen tanks so that while they waited in traffic to be unloaded, they didn't risk brain injury or potentially death. And we're talking about, you know, sergeants, lance corporals, corporals doing this. And then the captain who was in charge, you know, overseeing all of it, when he was speaking to the press, he was like, this is what small unit leadership is all about. And I really think that those are the stories. I know that we tend to focus on whether Trump should have done this or should have done that, whether these high-level decisions should have been made. There are so many variables in play that I don't think that there are right or wrong answers. There's just degrees of right and wrong. But at the unit level, at the company level, at the battalion level, at the regimental level, military leaders, Marines are making decisions every day that are genuinely saving lives. We don't see it because the news mostly talks about where the fires are, not where the fires have been put out. But, you know, leaders in the military right now, obviously Captain Crozier is one that's getting a lot of press, but leaders all across the military are making hard and good decisions right now that are saving people's lives right now. And let's not forget that just because we're talking so much about the decisions that we can find disagreement with. There are a lot of people.
Let me just
tell
you, here's one of the things that, you know, and I started teaching decision making in 1990. Because my thought was, why are we so bad at this? You know, and this is just walking for a couple of years behind lieutenants at the basic school and trying to teach, you know, smart, fit people, you know, how to make reads. And I thought, well, what do we really teach them about it? And the answer is nothing. We look at them and say, what now, lieutenant? Like, you're supposed to know when you don't have enough reps at doing this shit to know. And so, so to me, you know, so I developed a class. I think it's one of the first classes ever taught in the Marine Corps, a formal decision-making class, and especially relative to dynamic decision-making and getting comfortable in an environment where you might have 25 to 30% of the information that you need to make a decision, right? But that decision point is right in your face. You got to make it now, because if you don't, for instance, you know, somebody's going to die in an ambulance because they're, you know, your decision wasn't timely, you know, relative to their oxygen. And so to me, one of the interesting things about, you know, life is that whether you're talking about recovering from a hurricane or whether you're talking about, you know, responding to the COVID-19 crisis or whether you're talking about going to war, it's all, if you can get them to see it as, hey, you're a leader, and the requirement isn't perfection. The requirement is for you to evolve your decision to a win, okay? So don't worry about being perfect. Be decisive and then keep your head in the game and look for indicators that confirm or deny your decision. And then if when you start seeing the wrong indicators, like machine guns crossing to your front and mortars falling in dead space, so you just attack the prepared position, now what? Evolve that. We're Marines, man. What do? Everybody go to ground, smoke the deliberate position, and then what do? Right? You can either pull back, which is relatively risky, or you can plaster the shit out of it with everything you can. And if you can mass fires on it, then blow a flank into it and attack the flank you blow into it. But if you can get young Marines to see that every one of these things is equivalent to a quote-unquote combat decision because it's the same process, you know, then as you said, whether you're doing it in an ambulance in New York City or New York State, or you're doing it out in the desert, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. It's the same environment, and you never know when it's going to come your way. So learn how to do it. And again, and this is to me the biggest thing that I fought. You don't have to be perfect, okay? You've got to relentlessly pursue winning, not perfection, okay? So if you fuck,
that's an awesome quote right there. You should put that on a shirt.
If you fuck it up, unfuck it and relentlessly get after the win. Do not worry about being perfect.
You know, I think that if more people understood that type of decision making, politically, we'd be in a better place in this country. Because instead of holding our political figures accountable for any foreseen or unforeseen repercussions of their decisions, if we instead understood and appreciated that a lot of times these decisions are they're combat decisions. You know, these are command level decisions being made in the face of an adversary. They're not always going to result in the best possible outcome. But the important thing, well, just like you said, is to continue to manipulate the circumstances to the best of your ability. You mitigate those threats where you can. You place more power where you can. It's not about making one decision right or wrong today. It's about making a series of decisions moving forward to try to put us in the best position that we can be in. I don't just mean about the coronavirus, but I mean about unemployment within the absence of the coronavirus. I mean foreign policy, you know, when we're worried about China expanding its influence through the Belt and Road Initiative. It's not about – there are no such things, I would argue. Maybe that's too much absolute. There are very few situations in your life where you will be faced with a massive decision with simple right or wrong answers.
Right.
You know, everything is in degrees of value. And the best that you can do is keep moving that bar towards best possible outcome with the understanding that you're going to trip sometimes. Right. Tripping is not failing. Tripping is just part of the process.
Oh, yeah. It is. You know, when I started to teach the class, I read a book called The Teaching of Thinking. One of the guys was named Nickerson, and they were Harvard guys. So I was working at the infantry officer course. So I'm a captain. I call him up, and I said, hey, I'm a captain in the Marine Corps. I'm developing a course. Would you have time to talk to me? And they said, sure, why don't you? And we set up a time to call. So I called back, and they said, well, what kind of decision-making are you looking at? I said, well, compressed time, high stress. And they're like, we're a little bit more deliberate. You know, for us and in business, compressed time would be 90 days. And they said, when you talk about compressed time, what are you talking about? I said, seconds to minutes. And they were like,
at best, if you're lucky, right?
Right. They were like, oh, wow. And then, but they were fascinated by it, right? And he said, and you're in the Marines and you're investigating this? I said, yeah, well, that's our requirement. And how do you educate somebody? And they were like, oh my God, that's fascinating. How do you do it? And Alex, as you just rightly seized on, if you don't first imbue them with, do not worry about perfection. Do not worry about screwing it up. Worrying about things that we all hear playing sports when we're little. Keep your head in the game. Right? How does where I play change when there's a runner at second as opposed to the runner at first? How does, you know, where I throw the ball change when there's runners at second and third with one out as opposed to when there's runners at second and third with two outs? Right? That, if you can pay attention, if you can keep your head in the game and you know that you don't have to be perfect and you're educated to relentlessly pursue winning, right, you'll be able to do it. you'll be able to do it because you are going to fuck it up, no doubt, right? When you fuck it up, unfuck yourself and then relentlessly pursue, you know, what you've been assigned to do.
And I wish that we could embrace that more politically in this country, just in general.
No, it's the whole gotcha thing, right? I mean, as you and I were talking about before, right? You've got a polarized media, you know, and which promotes polarized political parties, and so then it's the whole gotcha game. Oh, you said this,
and we accuse people of being a flip flopper if they change their mind in the face of new information.
Right,
you know,
right.
Donald Trump is a great example. At first, he was very critical of people who were saying we should worry about the coronavirus. And then he was like, this is serious and we need to take it seriously. And he was taken to task for that, as opposed to saying, hey, he got the data feed, looked at the data and said, hey, I should change my position.
Right.
That's a good thing. That's what we should look for in our leaders.
Well, and also, you know, when – so somebody's giving you data – and then they're saying, so what we need to do is we need to shut down the country. And the response is, what? We've never shut down the country, right? Through all the different flus that have come.
That have come and gone, right? Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. The swine flu.
Right, the swine flu. Yeah. We've never done that. And now you're telling me, and so you're sitting there as a dynamic decision maker, and you're looking at what the economy is, the fact that there's an election in November, right? And this thing's going, okay? And I'm the president. And now you're telling me I've got to bring it all to an end? Yeah, you haven't met that data threshold. Like, yeah, I get it, but how about halfway measures? Like, I'm going to close off, you know, and which was, you know, again, if you go back and you see he's accused of being a xenophobe, right? A racist by shutting down flights from China to the United States. And now if you talk to Gavin Newsom and the governor of Washington, Oregon, they say, hey, look, for the Western Coast, that was essential. That bought us some time, because if you look at the cases from in New York City, the point of origin was Europe, and which is, you know, and so, but again, it's just our media. It either fits your narrative or it doesn't. If it fits, you blow it up. If it doesn't fit, you diminish it.
And it's important to note that you can hate Trump and think that he makes some good calls, and you can love Trump and think that he makes some bad calls. It's totally cool either way. You know, right. I've been a Bills fan my whole life. They have a habit of losing, so I'm very critical of the Buffalo Bills. I'm still a Bills fan, you know? And what you're pointing at is, I think, maybe the most important lesson for us to learn from this whole coronavirus situation, and that's that politics are not the most important thing in our country. Our economic well-being is more important than politics. Our health and wellness is more important than politics. And our tendency to associate it all to politics does us a disservice.
Right. And threading that needle, that combined needle of economics and health, is going to be very interesting to watch how different governors around the country do it.
And I think you're nailing it when calling it threading the needle. I think it's going to be difficult.
And again, it is that dynamic event. And if you encourage them with the same thing, there's no requirement to be perfect, all right? But as you come out of this, whatever you decide, keep your head in the game. Look for indicators that either confirm or deny the assumption that you made relative to that course of action. And when you see those indicators deny your assumption, you've got to have the courage to say, we're going backwards, folks. You've got to do that.
And I think we as the populace, my message to the world, if I could give one, would be A – you know, act responsibly on your own behalf. You don't need the government to shut things down for you to go, yeah, maybe I don't need to go to Hobby Lobby today. I can hold off, you know. Spend money. Don't save all your money. Don't stuff it in a mattress. Spend money like you normally would. Be responsible for yourself and for the people around you, your family. And when your leaders, when your governor or the president or whoever it may be makes a decision that you don't like, try not to see that as the end of the world and focus instead on what you can do where you are. You know, our leaders are going to try to work this out the best that they can, you know, and all we can do is try to get through this the best that we can. Right. So if you focus on you, it'll be less stressful than if you're worrying about what Donald Trump is enforcing for Montana or whatever, right? And if you focus on you, it'll be less stressful than worrying about whether or not your governor is going to let people go to TGI Fridays. Focus on you and what you can control. My therapist calls it in your donut and outside your donut, right? Inside your donut is all the stuff you can affect. Outside your donut is the stuff that you can't. We tend to focus a lot. We tend to focus primarily on the stuff outside our donut. Try to focus on what's inside your donut and what you can do, and we're going to get through this. Not all of us will, unfortunately, and many of us are going to be in a tough place on the other side of this. Right now, our focus is get to the other side. When we get to the other side, our focus can be on rebuilding whatever we lose.
Somebody sent me an email and said, "Hey, Mac, I would just want to regurgitate something you said over the last couple weeks and think it's appropriate here. We are relearning lessons our grandparents learned in the Depression, in the Dust Bowl, during World War II, when the nation sacrificed. We're learning why they had large savings accounts. It was because of real-world events in their lives that taught them lessons. We have largely been spared of that as a culture since World War II. There are great lessons for all of us in terms of managing money, saving money, and living within our means resident in all of this. We're relearning how smart our grandparents were to embrace that stuff, but also understanding that they lived through some pretty difficult times, and that's how they learned those things. I have shared that with everybody that I've come in contact with when this subject comes up, and I have not got any pushback on it. I think it's wise advice. No, I mean, it's just like, look, you wonder why your grandparents would say, "Hey, so are you saving any money? You got that good job right now." And you go, "Come on, Grandma, I got a credit card and I'm good, thank you." Well, I mean, now we learned where those sayings of "pay as you go, you won't owe" come from. It came from the difficult, difficult times in their lives when, you know, the Depression went on for close to a decade, right? You know, hobo camps.
And we as Americans now do not really have a scope to fully appreciate that.
Well, but a lot of people are getting it.
Honestly, I got to say credit to you and credit to them for bringing that back up. I couldn't imagine a better lesson to learn from this.
Well, no, it's interesting. It's the historical perspective, right, of, you know, we haven't sacrificed as a nation since World War II. I mean, in the last 20 years, we've been approximately 20 years been fighting war, but that's really only a small percentage of the country. Everybody else has been unencumbered as they go to the lake and go skiing and live their lives on their terms with nothing impact them. And now this,
and I agree.
And you have a lot of families doing what you're doing, Alex. We're at home together every night, which is not that different from you work at home. But if you and your wife both worked outside the house, it would be fundamentally different. And all the things people are rediscovering, right? Dinner at home,
dinner together, trying to decide on a TV show that we can actually all like.
Right. James Bond. Well, you have a younger daughter, but after she falls asleep.
I love the James Bond movies.
We watched Spectre last night.
And I haven't seen that one yet.
I would recommend it. I hadn't seen it either. And it was good. It was good. So anyway, look, I know I've kept you too long. You got to work. I appreciate your time as always. Sandbox, right?
Sandbox News. You guys got News. Sandbox with two X's, sandboxnews.com. Yeah. And I want to say, anybody listening, obviously Mac and I get fired up about this. It's because this is important. It is important. But it's important for us all to remember that we're not really coming from very different positions. Mac and I included. You know, he and I agree on 99% of all of this. It's okay to debate. It's okay to argue with your friends and with your family. I've got buddies who think this is a hoax. You know, it's okay to argue, but try to remember that you're arguing for good reason. You're arguing because you care about the people. You're arguing because you care about what happens. You're not arguing because you're mad at each other. Everybody's tense right now. You know, my wife and I are arguing just because we're stuck in a house together. It's important and valuable to debate. But just keep it in mind. Keep it in mind that we're all on the same team.
There you have it. Alex Hollings. Thanks, bud. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
All right. There you have it with his new microphone. if you're just tuning in, today in history, you're going to hear a little bit about. And what ours really, what I was really looking for was, there was two things I had in my head, and the website I went to was, you know, April 20th being Hitler's birthday and Weed Day. So I started going through it, and they didn't have something about either one of them, which, I, you know, publicizing Hitler's birthday, probably not something that most websites would want to do. And then there's a story I just ran across, how 420 became Weed Day. So, the legends of the California Penal Code. Some claim the number 420 is drawn from the California criminal codes used to punish the use or distribution of marijuana. But the state's 420 code actually applies to obstructing entry on public land. So, not really. The legend of the police radio code. Neither the LAPD or the New York Police Department even have a code 420. San Francisco police have one, but it's for a juvenile disturbance. So, never mind that one. The legend of the Dylan song. This one is a nod to Bob Dylan's song, Rainy Day Women. Its lyrics, everybody must get stoned. Multiply 12 by 35 and you get 420. Seems a bit of a stretch. The 420 time became a code. Hold on. The legend of the Waldos. According to Chris Conrad, curator of the Amsterdam Cannabis Museum in Oakland, California, 420 started as a secret code among high schoolers in the early 1970s. A group of friends in the San Rafael High School in Marin County who called themselves the Waldos would often meet at 420 to get high. For them, it was an ideal time. They were out of school, their parents weren't home yet, giving them a window of unsupervised freedom. They met at that time every day near a statue of Louis Pasteur. The 420 time became a code for them to use in front of their unsuspecting parents, and 420 gradually spread from there, possibly via Grateful Dead followers across California and beyond. It's even the number of a California Senate bill that established the state's medical marijuana program. What was shorthand for a group can now be seen on t-shirts and throughout pop culture, and of course on our calendar every year. So, Weed Day. Congratulations. So, but I didn't find it. I didn't find that. So, you'll hear a little bit of Today in History. And then Alex will join us and we talk about the coronavirus. And how do you, if you're a governor, how do you come out? How do you come out of this? And the problem is that you're going to want to say that it's a, you know, it's one, then two, then three. But the truth is that it might be one, then two, then three, then two, then two, then two, then three, then four, then three, then three, then four, then five, then six, then seven. Right? And so conditions-based dynamic decision-making. It's a little bit of a different model, and certainly you can see one that is going to lend itself to a lot of different interpretations, so it'll be interesting. Yeah. So anyway, tomorrow, Dennis Katolin joins us. Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps, author in this month's Gazette, writing about information operations. What does that even mean? We hear about it a lot, right? What does it even mean? And then towards the end of the discussion, we talk to him about, in a peer war, you know, what happens? You know, what happens? What happens to our satellites? What happens to our ability to commute? What happens to our ability to see, right? All these things that we have, be they manned platforms, unmanned platforms, or satellites, what happens when, you know, we get our eyes poked out relative to identifying enemy targets and engaging those targets with these awesome weapons that shoot thousands of miles but are essentially useless if you can't spot the target? So we'll talk to him about that. So anyway, on this 20th of April, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and done for the day.